Hello, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the final series of our 2023 podcast, the Imaginarium series, recorded live at Bangalore Showgrounds on Arakwal Bunjalung land. Coming up, The Family Spark is a compelling conversation with Shankari Chandran, Shirley Lay, Peter Pilates and Gemma Birrell.
Hello everyone and welcome. Today we're standing and sitting on the lands of the Arakwal, Bumbabin and Minjingbul people of the Bunjalung Nation. My deep respect to the traditional owners, the original storytellers of this beautiful land. My name is Gemma Birrell and today I'm speaking with Shankari Chandran, Shirley Lee and Peter Pilates, whose books have moved, shaken and absorbed me in different ways. Our panel is called The Family Spark, and we'll be looking at inheritance, home, migration, and the possibilities of fiction, diving into the worlds of each author and what they've created. So in the next hour, we're going to spend some time with each author separately, and then we'll also, and each author will do a reading, and then there'll be some conversation between us all. Shirley Lee is a Vietnamese-Australian writer from Yaguna and a creative producer at Sweatshop Literacy Movement. Her writing has been published in places like Overland, The Guardian and Mianjin, and she co-wrote the play Sex, Drugs and Pork Rolls. Funny Ethnics is her first novel that Michelle Law described as astute, unsentimental and extremely fun. Peter Pilates is the author of the novels Down the Hume and The Pillars, which won the Premier's Multicultural New South Wales Literary Award. He also won the Woollahra Digital Literature Prize for fiction, and in 2021 was the ACT Writer-in-Residence at the UNSW Canberra. His new novel that we'll be talking about today is God Forgets About the Poor. And as Maxine Benaber-Clark said, it's moving, poetic, powerful, at once a folk tale and a modern-day lament. Shankari Chandran has just won the Miles Franklin Award for Chai Time at the Cinnamon Gardens, which is such thrilling news. Congratulations.
Thank you.
She's also spent 2 decades working in social justice as a lawyer and is the Deputy Chair of Writing New South Wales. Her other novels are The Barrier and Song of the Sun God that was listed for various awards and published for the first time in Australia at the end of last year. I love Emily Maguire's description of this book, which is of her work, which is engrossing, urgent, warm, wise, and utterly, utterly beautiful. So let's start by setting the scene. Can each of you give a brief overview of what your books are about and where the idea to write them first came from? Shirley, can you start for us, please?
So Funny Ethnics is the story of Sylvia Nguyen, and she's a second generation Vietnamese Australian girl growing up in Western Sydney in a small little place called Yaguna. And Funny Ethnics traces her path to finding out who she is and who she's not.
My book started when after I won an award and my mother said that I can't continue writing my gay books and she demanded I write a story about her life.
It's just going to be hard to follow. Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome.
So Song of the Sun God is about 3 generations of Sri Lankan Tamil women and the choices that they make to survive Sri Lanka's civil war. It began as a response to coming back to Australia and coming back home to Australia and feeling that Australia was no longer home for me and my difficulty in navigating my identity here. And then Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens is set in a nursing home, and it's about the community that we build in that nursing home set against the backdrop of rising racism in contemporary Australia.
Thank you. Peter, Honoured is the name of the mother character in this book. Her perspective is done so well, and at the beginning, the first-person perspective is of hers is one of the best that I've read. You can feel her presence in the way she talks, and she just really, really comes alive. So how did you create her on the page and bring her alive so fully?
I recorded my mum a lot, but at the same time I imagined, because my mum speaks to me in Greek, I had to try and write it in English in her tone, which is fast, didactic, subversive and melancholic at the same time.
Nail it.
My sister reckons I got her voice down. Yeah. So I trust my sister. And I this book is about my migrant mother, you know, and so that women of those generation, those migrant women, they're just punchlines in media. They're just, they're jokes, you know. So I just really wanted to see a real person fleshed out.
And you were just saying that you interviewed her. Did you interview other people as well in order to kind of form a perspective, or was it just your mother that you interviewed? How did you do that?
Well, there's just stories that I got from my cousins and my auntie that I just wouldn't have got from my mother. And one of them was getting an idea of the character of my grandmother and what kind of person she was, because your mother will tell you one thing and other people will tell you other stuff. But my cousin, who was born here, exactly my age, she's really smart. She got 2 economics degrees and she moved back to the village and she married a fisherman from our village. And she's got the best relationship in the family, by the way, just so you know, with her husband. And he tells this story of knowing my grandmother. And my grandmother had a loquat tree in front of her house in the village. And rather than... And the children would go and steal some of the loquats from the tree. And rather than give the loquats, she'd shoo the children away. So it was stories like that that gave me a sense of the character of people rather than just from my perspective.
Right. Could you read us an extract so we can all hear some of your wonderful writing?
From there to there, right?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Start when I was born. Describe the village and how beautiful it was on the side of a mountain but in the middle of a forest. If we walked to a certain point on the edge, we could look over the valley and see the rain clouds coming. Sometimes we would see a cat on a roof and we would read that as a warning of a storm. When we looked down, we saw the dirt, which was just as rich as the sky. My island, your island, our island. It's named after the white rocks at the mountain peak. It's those same rocks that make the ground full of nitrate, a natural fertilizer. Set the story there. This is geography, but start on the day that I was born. Add salt and paper and fat. Say that the October rains were creating a fine mist on the day, that the air turned to glass, that something in the weather was special. Make it magical in the way that artists do. You're supposed to be a writer. Try and write something good this time. Be interesting. Our villages on the island are hidden, up winding roads in recesses between mountains. Back in time, it would have been harder for raiders and pirates to go. People call them villages, but really they're settlements. They're made up of a series of neighbourhoods, and it might have been that there was good shelter on the side of the mountains, or it was closer to farming, so they congregated and set up dwellings and such. In those neighbourhoods, we kept each other safe. If a girl was approached by some tacky boy, some wannabe bandit, the men might gather and visit him, have some hard words. Or sometimes the eyes of the village would watch from around the corners and see that one of the families hadn't harvested enough before winter, give them some extra stores before they could ask. Much was unsaid but monitored. Do you remember when we were there? That time you and your cousin went to the beach on the other side of the island? By the time you came back, someone else had told me where you were. That kind of safety, you can only get there. What do you mean it's not interesting? People will want my story. My God, I sound like one of those wogs that used to come to the library asking where they could tell their story. You know, they publish their own books. But my story is unique, I promise. I was born in the smoke of the World War. Tell them that. Guns and cannons going off in canyons as my mother let me enter the world. The exact place. A hospital? No, you fool. I came out of my mother in that same house we stay in every time we visit Greece. That more like a hut than a house. Two rooms only. Imagine me being born while bombs exploded all around and the soldiers travelling up and down roads. I'm sure I was born there. No, wait, I wasn't born there. It was another house that we were renting. There was an earthquake on the island in 1938. It demolished our family house, and your grandfather took way too long to rebuild. We rented near the school at the top of the village, and beyond it was a forest that was too close to the foxes. Me and my sisters came out of our mother, five girls born and burning.
Thank you. Thank you. No, wait, not that's not right.
Lots of that.
Tell me, like, how do you interview, like, how do you kind of navigate around the unreliability of memory, different accounts, and then create the creature that is a novel?
I try and incorporate it. So I think we all have flawed memories of what happened, and I had multiple flawed memories. There's five girls that my mother was born into, and all their children, which were all on the family group chat all together, all the cousins. And so I just throw in a question there and people would answer.
That's so convenient.
Yeah. But I think part of this kind of writing, whether it's a fiction or an autofiction or a biography fiction, is I have to incorporate the unreliability into it.
Mm. And just in terms of how, I mean, books are always kind of a mix of truth and fiction, and there's different levels of that. But I guess how did the imaginative work of your own writerly craft work? Like, how did you kind of pull in your imagination into this book?
I think I have a very limited imagination, which is why I really had to ask my cousins for stories. And even still, there's just chapters where I relied on other texts and objects. Mm. Like the third chapter is written in a Mrs. Dalloway style, and it's my mum in Athens when the junta, was just taking over. So the streets was full of soldiers. But I have a like younger auntie, and because we're from a communist family, my younger auntie was like throwing Molotov cocktails, and my mother was working at like a pastry shop, going to uni, and like living in a rom-com in her head. So,
how was she living in a rom-com?
She just wanted a husband or boyfriend, or you know, like, and my and she, you know, walked past. I think she dated one of the soldiers for a while there too. Which is cute. And but to research that, I read Mrs. Dalloway, the voice that Virginia Woolf was doing there. You know, she does those flourishes and that close third person looking at the character. But then I also watched the 1970s Greek New Wave films. So, you know, you all know that they're like they're like, you all know Alain Delon and that, you know, 70s New Wave in France. Well, that was happening everywhere and even in Greece. And so I watched some of those films to get a sense of Athens. And so I think I have a very limited imagination.
So in terms of the other characters, Peter, are they very close to the real people in your lives? And in terms of All Holy as well?
All Holy, me, I'm All Holy. That's what I did with the names is I literally translated them into the language. So if you heard my name in Greek, it would literally translate to All Holy, whereas my mother's name would be Honoured. If there was a George in the book, they would be called Farmer. You know, if there was my auntie Belagia, Belagos, Open Sea, which some of you might have heard before.
Open Sea is the most poetic name.
Yeah, well, that's literally their name. We're like named after elements sometimes. But yeah, they're all close to me, and I hope I did them justice.
Mm. We're going to shift now onto to Shirley's work. Shirley, can you tell me a little bit about, I mean, often first novels are considered, or people think that a lot of first novels have elements of autobiography in them. Can you tell me, did your novel have those elements, or is it purely fictional? Like, are there layers of truth? I'm curious about how that worked for you.
For me, I think that all writing is inherently autobiographical. So even if a work is labelled science fiction, I would think that it's autobiographical in a way, because it reveals things about the creator that perhaps the creator didn't intend for it to reveal. So for Funny Ethnics, I can't say that everything that happened in this book happened in my personal life, but all of the feelings that Sylvia Nguyen goes through in this book, I have felt those feelings in my personal life. So that's how I would answer your question.
Oh, there's so much pressure on Sylvia, or she feels pressure from her family, from her parents, to perform, to go to a selective school, to get into that selective school. And then after that, there's the next level, which is performing, you know, of continuing that study and being a lawyer. And so there's the role that she's expected to be in. But Sylvia has very different ideas for herself, doesn't she?
Yes. So Sylvia wants to, I guess, become an artist, a writer, and she doesn't know where to start. And I guess that's because everywhere that she looks, especially in terms of like coming from Western Sydney, she thinks that Western Sydney is like some sort of cultural wasteland, even though it's so rich in culture. But she just doesn't have access to the arts. And I think that's mirrored in my personal journey as well. As someone who's second generation Vietnamese Australian growing up in Western Sydney, I felt like I didn't know where to begin to access arts in Australia. And so, yeah, Funny Ethnics mirrors that journey.
There's a little bit in there as well about cultural inheritance. And we were speaking a bit earlier today about not just family, but the role that other artists and writers might play in your life, but also might play in the life of the character, Shirley. Mm. I mean, Sylvia. Sylvia. So, and one writer in particular who you mention is Nam Lee in the book. Can you share a bit about that scene and about Nam Lee for Sylvia and what
Nam Lee and his book, The Boat, which I'm sure many of you may know of. Yes, he is referenced in Funny Ethnics as well as Viet Thanh Nguyen's The Sympathizer. And so for me, that idea of inherited stories, I'd like to kind of expand that into the stories that are inherited within the growing body of literature in the Vietnamese diaspora. So after the Vietnam War, many Vietnamese families kind of escaped to different countries, and I think there's a really exciting emergence of stories coming from like these hybrid identities of what it means to be Vietnamese but living overseas. And so for me, reading stories written by a fellow Vietnamese-Australian like Nam Le or a Vietnamese-American like Viet Thanh Nguyen, when I read their stories, I want to respond in a way, because there's no singular story that can capture our experiences. And so it's a conversation to me. When I produce a work like Funny Ethnics, I feel like I'm speaking to the men in my community or speaking to the elder generations in our community, and it's very special to me in that way.
Thank you. Could you give us a reading, please?
Of course. Mandarins were cheaper in winter, selling for $3 a kilo. They would be stacked at the entrance of Bankstown Woolworths, each one a glistening nugget of Fanta orange with an Australia-shaped sticker stuck on it. The sticker was the size of a 5-cent coin with the word Imperial stamped across it. Mum would buy 2 kilos of mandarins and disperse them into ceramic bowls laid out across our house, on the kitchen table beside her meditation tapes, on the living room table beside a photo of her and Ba riding a moped in Saigon, and on top of the bedside drawer near the portable radio she used to listen to SBS Vietnamese. She said, "Mandarin is a nung food. It will warm your belly." Mum believed in traditional Chinese medicine's segregation of food according to their hot or cool energies. When I was 4, she caught me sneaking a packet of caramello koalas into our shopping trolley. She dumped the packet back on the shelf and lectured me about hot and cool foods. According to thousands of years of Chinese medicine, hot or nung foods were believed to improve blood circulation and warm the body internally, while cool or mac foods were said to be effective in purging toxins. To be healthy was to harbour a balance between hot and cool energies. Too much hot food, like caramello koalas, could worsen a volatile temper, while too much coldness in your diet could lead to depression. When I was in kindergarten, Mum enrolled me into local Saturday Vietnamese school at La Salle Boys College in Bankstown. I sat at a desk with a mysterious carving on it, a stick wedged between two circles. The drawing was done in blue biro and etched deep into the wood. I thought of what I would draw once I obtained my pen license. The principal at Saturday Viet School was Sister Hing, a wiry nun with cheekbones covered in hundreds of freckles. She wore a grey head covering and an apron that revealed taut ankles encased in grey stockings. In the mornings, we would gather in the basketball courts of the school and sing two national anthems, Tiếng Gọi Công Dân and Advance Australia Fair. Then we'd file away to class where Cô Nga, a teller at Bankstown Commonwealth Bank by day, would begin the lesson. She reminded me of Ursula from The Little Mermaid with her purple shawl cascading over rolls of flesh and a lone grey streak in her hair. One time, Cô Nga handed out snake lollies and packets of neon-coloured sherbet nerds. I chewed on a blackberry snake, stretching its gummy flesh, while she said, "Before France, there was China. China colonised Vietnam for 1,000 years, and yet Vietnam remains Vietnam." I swallowed the snake's head. Throughout high school, I'd repeat this line to myself, "Vietnam remains Vietnam." I'd repeat it when the Chinese and Hong Kong girls in my friendship group gossiped about how stuffed a country was if Angelina Jolie had to adopt kids from there. I'd repeat it when a Chinese boy I had a crush on told me there was no difference whether you came from Vietnam or China. One morning, my mother barged into my room yelling, "China, they mung nuoc Việt Nam luôn." She showed me a photo on her phone of a red Chinese ship spraying water on a shabby brown Vietnamese vessel. It was a low-quality photo with visible pixels. I thought it was a photo from one of those email chains that her friends passed among themselves, linking everything back to how communism was destroying Vietnam. But as I scrolled through my phone on the train to work, I saw the same photo on the Sydney Morning Herald's Facebook page with the caption, "Chinese ships ramming and spraying water cannons at Vietnamese vessels, trying to stop Beijing from setting up an oil rig in the South China Sea." I spread my thumb and index finger across the screen to enlarge the photo. I wanted to see if there were any Viets on the deck of the vessel shielding their faces from the incoming water or raising their fists in defiance as the water exploded around them. But the image was blurred by the water from the Chinese ship. I pressed the home button on my phone. Why was my mother so upset about Vietnam losing some land in the Spratly Islands? All my life, she'd told me that the country of Vietnam was dead to her.
Thank you. Thank you. Sylvia Julia says in the book that everything she knows about Vietnam is filtered through her parents. And she also says that she doesn't know much about how they got to Australia by boat. And at one point she says, "I knew my parents were classified as refugees because they'd come to Australia by boat, but I knew very little of that journey. Something about dressing up as happy wedding guests to evade the Khong An at the ports." And she continues. And that made me think, Shirley, what about the stories that you don't hear? How much do they, that you don't hear from your parents, how much do they inform your writing?
I think coming from a second generation perspective is about having that opacity where you don't really know how exactly your parents experienced the Vietnam War or that particular boat journey, but it still impacts you anyway, and the way that you grow up and the way that you see your mother country. And so I really wanted to hone in on that in Funny Ethnics, because I do hear about those feelings in my community where people from my generation want to know about what has happened to their parents on that particular boat journey, or what happened to their parents during the Vietnam War. But I also wanted to emphasise in Funny Ethnics that sharing those stories is actually quite traumatising and can be re-traumatising to elders from the first generation. And so I wanted to approach that complexity with a respect and to be comfortable with that, those particular stories being opaque. I also wanted to say that being Vietnamese Australian, existing in that hyphen between Vietnamese and Australian, is having an opacity about what it means to be Australian as well. So everything that Sylvia understands about Australian culture is filtered through popular media that she sees on Australian TV. And so it's not only the stories that she doesn't have access to when it comes to Vietnamese culture, but it's also about the stories that she doesn't have access to being an Australian in Australia.
Thank you. And I think you use humour in such an interesting way as well, which ties into what you were just saying. The book is very funny at times, but also it's very dark, and you use humour in a way, in a kind of ironic, self-aware, turning itself on the racism of Australia as well. Can you tell me more about how you do that and how humour can help and highlight different elements?
Personally, humour has always been a salve to me in terms of, like, coping with things in life. But to offer a literary answer to your question, I think humour is actually a serious literary device that has always fascinated me. I think when we laugh, it can come from a broad spectrum of feelings, not just joy. Anything can be a laugh from, like, a sneer to, like, a full, rich laughter that bubbles up from your belly. And the physicality of that has always fascinated me. And as an artist, it was something that I really wanted to explore in my first work. So, yeah.
Thank you. We're now going to move to Shankri, to your work. At the start of Song of the Sun God, you dedicate it to Amama and Abs, the original Nala and Rajan. Can you talk about how they inspired these characters?
Yeah, so Nala and Rajan are the protagonists of Song of the Sun God, and their personalities, a lot of the anecdotes are very closely based on them. And I started to write, actually, the first sort of character years before I sat down to write the novel, I'd had a miscarriage and I was really deeply very upset by it. And my writing, I attended a writing course at my husband's suggestion that I would help, that creating would help me heal. And so the creative writing teacher said, pick a character and just give that character something to do every day. And I picked my grandmother, who I'm very close to, and she's her 1-year anniversary of her passing yesterday. And she helped to raise us or has been a really formidable presence in our lives. And so I picked her and then every day just gave my grandmother something to do, and that evolved into a novel later.
Wow. The story is so bound up in the history of the country, in the Civil War. There's the three generations who go through this period. Why was fiction itself the right way to tell these truths?
So I think in Sri Lanka, fiction... Well, in Sri Lanka, the truth is very difficult to tell. And the truth of what happened in our civil war, the truth of what happened particularly at the end of the civil war, the genocide and the injustices around all of that have been very much hidden and erased and buried. And you simply can't tell the truth in Sri Lanka. And so then... And I am a lawyer and felt really just so disappointed by the failures of the law and the failures of the justice system to provide any kind of justice for our people. And then let down by my own systems of power as well as myself, that I had nothing or could do nothing. And so I turned to fiction as something that could reappropriate the truth, could reclaim the truth, and create within it a space to tell those stories and to tell the truth. And initially, I thought it would really just be my parents and my children that would read it, because it was going to be my gift to my children. And then as I kept writing, I really felt this urgency about wanting more people to read it and to understand what had happened to us.
How much are stories coming out in Sri Lanka about the history? How open is Sri Lanka now with its past?
Yeah, not very open. No, it's not very open. I mean, in the north and the east, memorials to the conflict are memorials to the fallen soldiers from the Sri Lankan army in our traditional homeland. And they're appalling to look at because they do not remember the Tamil dead. They do not allow us to remember the dead. And so even in, you know, something as simple, not as simple, as complicated as the burning of the Jaffna Library, which is a scene that features in both of my novels, the erasure of memory and the erasure of culture has been going on for a very long time, and so they don't remember it.
Are your books published over there?
Yes, so Song of the Sun God was initially published there, actually, because I couldn't find a publisher here in Australia at the time. When I first tried to publish it, I was told it wasn't Australian enough. Because a story about, you know, colonisation, dispossession, forced migration and the creation of home... was clearly not Australian. Well, it's for all of them, right? Yeah. So I then ended up publishing it in Sri Lanka in English. And I remember saying, you know, to the publisher, will I be okay? And he said, as long as you don't have any political aspirations, then you'll be fine. I was like, well, okay, sure. I have no political aspirations. I don't even have literary aspirations. So excellent. But I think now increasingly my parents are in the front row and you know, every time we talk about going back to Sri Lanka, I can sense them really itching to steal my passport. Because I think increasingly as my work becomes more public and more high profile, it could be more concerning.
Can you tell me a bit about the two different novels and how you see them? Because they're so distinct. There's such a different feel and character to both of these incredible novels. But they also, there's some crossovers and some experiences that are shared. And a big part of that is Sri Lanka, of course. The history. Are some of the characters, are the connections between some of the characters between them? And how do you see the difference between both of those novels, if they were kind of personalities in a sense? Like, how do you describe them?
So I would see Song of the Sun God as being the more serious and studious sibling in the family. It's quite dense. I'm trying to sell the book, so, you know, it's dense, but still very readable, people. And it follows 70 years, right, of history and generations and continents. It is very much that first diasporic novel where you mine so much of your own existence and experiences and emotions and your family anecdotes, much to their dismay, if not delight. but it is a very ambitious in its scope, I think. I'm not suggesting it executed it, but it's
a huge amount of
in
history,
its
isn't it?
It's yes.
Extraordinary.
And I really wanted to question, I wanted to give people the history, the Tamil history, not just the Sri Lankan history, right? What is the Sri Lankan history compared to the Tamil history? And what is it that you read and receive in the West when you think of Sri Lanka? And I wanted to have a Tamil story. And I loved what you said, Shirley, about there's no one Vietnamese story, right? There are many of our stories, and each of us want to respond to each other's stories and add to that body of collective work. And so I wanted to give a Tamil story to that. And then at the same time, Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens, I became much more confident as a writer, right? Through mentorship and reading great writing and just growing more confident within myself, and also hitting 45 and thinking, screw it, you know, nothing really matters. Yeah. So I really approached Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens as though it would never be published. I just assumed that my publishing career in Australia was over, which gave me a very strong sense of freedom and liberation to just write as I wanted to write. At the same time...
It's good to hear that there was a positive element to that.
Oh, it was tremendous. Yeah, it was incredibly liberating to just really want to embrace and lean into writing about race in a way that I'd been previously very frightened to do. And then secondly, to also think tonally as a writer, how is your audience going to receive it? And lawyers always think about this, how do you best communicate with your client? And if I think of my readers as my client... To really separate it, though, from the white gaze and from the marketing gaze, because it was never going to get marketed, never going to get published, but to think, what is the conversation that I want to have with my reader? How will I help them understand my rage? And how will I take them on my journey through the stories that I'm telling or the stories that my characters are telling?
It's really interesting what you were saying earlier in the day as well about... how you tell these stories so people can digest them. So I wonder about that, because there's such darkness in this history, but also there's such warmth of different characters that you bring in, such humanity, that it kind of the different stories in the nursing home, for example, Maya, who is such a uniting force, and Anjali, like they tell me about how you kind of marry that darkness with these kind of the warmth, I guess, of these contemporary stories.
Yeah.
But also the harshness of some of these contemporary stories.
Yeah, thank you. I first probably respond by saying, Peter, liar, liar, pants on fire, because I, when he says he doesn't have a broad imagination, I think there's extraordinary... I think it's in the writing, right? You just write what you see, and when you write what you see, what you're writing is the expanse of human existence and imagination and experience, and therefore these stories are so expansive, because I think all three of us are writing what we see. And that's where the truth of it is. And the truth of it is that life is dark and that life is light, that there is levity and there is humour and there is grief and rage and love. So if you just write what you see, then you're writing all of that.
Language is a huge part of all of your novels. The voice that it's told in, the choice of language or languages, and the Tamil language that you write so evocatively about, you really bring it alive, and you bring it alive in so many ways, like the way language holds culture, it holds history, and it holds myth. And the myth that the title is referring to, or the Sanskrit, the sacred text. Can you tell us about where that song of the sun god comes from and what the role of myth is in the Tamil culture?
So the title is Song of the Sun God, and it comes from the Bhagavad Gita, which is our kind of like our Bible, only shorter. It's much shorter. It's much more... It's straight to the point, but kind of... less lyrical. And the Bhagavad Gita means the great song. And so song is from there. And the sun god is Surya for us, who I really love. And we, you know, you worship the sun. The sun gives us everything, gives us life. And then mythology in Hinduism and in Tamil culture is such a part of our life. We grow up reading these awesome comics called Ammachitrakatha books, and that's how you learn culture and religion and morals, and they're quite violent, so I'm not really sure that the moral tone of it could be questionable. But we are learning through these stories, initially in comic form, and then as we learn to read better in the sort of big form. And so mythology and the storytelling of mythology is a huge part of growing up. And it's just part of our lives. And we name our children after deities, after gods, after the elements, and after the characters in the Mahabharata and in the Ramayana and so on. And so it's just day to day, really. We slip into mythology as quickly as we slip into fact.
Could you read us an extract, please?
Sure, thank you. Right. Tamil was the language he loved the most. He missed the way his mother spoke to him, the endearments as well as the orders she gave him. Nothing expressed love the way their language did. Nala would argue that he never expressed his love, at least not to her or even the children. She was wrong. Rajan prayed every night for his wife and children, and when he did it, it was in Tamil. When he was proud of his family, when he feared for them, when he was happy to see them, his heart soared in Tamil, even if his voice was silent. He remembered going as a boy to the public library in Jaffna with his mother. The community loved the library. They could see its value for them and their children. Families and temples started to give books and manuscripts to the library, some written on palm leaves which had been preserved and passed down for generations. There were original documents recording the history of the Tamil people in Ceylon and India, as well as new works by Tamil writers and thinkers. There were newspapers published in Jaffna and even old photographs of the past century. He remembered the piles of books scattered everywhere. He liked to hide among them, reading and sometimes organizing them. They comforted him. The first time in his life he had broken the rules was by staying at the library past its closing time. Sometimes he stayed deliberately. Sometimes he simply lost track of time and place as he read. He sat now in the library of Colombo General Hospital, almost half a century later, thinking about Mr. Kanagasabe, the curator of the Jaffna Public Library. For over a year, he and the curator cleaned and filed the manuscripts that would form one of Asia's greatest collections of Tamil literature. Wearing soft white gloves, he tenderly turned the yellowed pages, often stopping to read aloud to the old man. Later, Rajan moved to Colombo for university, but he returned to Jaffna whenever he could. By 1953, the community realized its library was overflowing with knowledge that needed to be preserved and housed better, and the construction of the Jaffna Public Library began. The library was not just for Tamils, it was for everyone. It was going to be a resource for the world, or at least those who were interested in the Tamil culture that had come from South India and taken on a shape of its own on their small island. The people were so proud. The library contained not only their history, but also their communal memory. It represented how far they had come and gave them hope for how far they would go. At the height of its collection, there were almost 100,000 books by Tamils and about Tamils. It was to be a stately building, the most beautiful in the region, and although the first wing of the library was only opened in 1959, long after he left Jaffna, he had seen and would remember forever the treasures it contained. An orange robe wrapped itself around him, around his books. He opened his eyes to survey the hospital library once more. His hands trembled a little as he smoothed the pages of his Tamil newspaper and traced the date, 2nd of June, 1981. Nothing had been reported in the national papers. He had already read the article several times and it was finally sinking in. The Tamil United Liberation Front had held another rally in Jaffna on the weekend, resulting in attacks on the temple and over 100 Tamil homes and shops. Eyewitness reports from two Sinhalese cabinet members who watched the main attack from a nearby rest house called it an unfortunate incident. The politicians did not express regret. They reiterated that if the Tamils were unhappy, they should leave Sri Lanka. Rajan folded the paper and held it to his chest. He could remember every word, although he did not want to believe it. On Sunday night, the police and the army had started the burning, emboldened by government support. It hadn't taken long. One night was all they needed. the Jaffna Public Library and every book inside it was burned to the ground. Rajan had no words and no language. He closed his eyes and wept.
Mm. Thank you. Oh, thank you, Shankari. That is a scene, it has such an impact, and that scene is told in different ways in the book, in the two different books.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you first heard about this library yourself, Shankari.
So I feel like I've cleared the room now. Sorry, guys.
Oh.
I'm so sorry. this happened in 1981, so within my lifetime, right? I was born in 1974. I was 7 years old when it happened.
Did you still have family in Sri Lanka?
We did at the time. So our extended family left. 1981 effectively led to 1983, which was the major communal riot that then was the catalyst, or the beginning of the war, rather.
Mm.
So, and that was called Black July, and you can imagine why. And so in 1981, when this happened, we were children and received the news, but largely through our parents, right? So we and my parents are there, so I will not look at them because then I'll cry and more people will leave. but it was, you know, we received the news. I am not trying to tease you. We received the news through them and their lens of grief and sadness and the ways in which their culture was being erased and the guilt at not being there, really. This is such a complex thing to be in the diaspora. Mm. And so we as children received it in that way. But really then as I grew older and grew to love libraries and stories and books, I could understand better the symbolism of the library and the symbolism of the burning of a library.
Yeah. Shirley, talking about the symbolism of language, in your book you use Vietnamese throughout. Can you talk about the importance of using Vietnamese in your novel?
It was important for me to use Vietnamese in the novel because Sylvia is Vietnamese-Australian, I'm Vietnamese-Australian, but I wanted to use Vietnamese in a way that also highlighted that second-generation perspective where she doesn't necessarily have the most fluent understanding of Vietnamese, and I think that in a way is how she processes culture as well. There's this idea called Sapir-Whorf, which is how the language that you speak can influence how you see reality. And I wanted to talk about a playful part of the book where Sylvia Nguyen's dad has a nemesis at the local butchery, and it's a woman who shows off about her son a lot. And one day he's standing outside the butchery and he's like, oh, look at her, she's in there. You know, she's showing off so much that the roof is going to blow open. And in Vietnamese, if someone's showing off too much, we say they're nol. And nol means exploding. And so in Funny Ethnics, I wrote that section where I said, I translated it for non-Vietnamese speakers to say, oh, she's in there and she's exploding. She's showing off so much that the whole room is exploding, basically. And so I wanted to use language in a way to communicate a different reality to readers and use it playfully as well. I think translation is an act of art making as well. I think everyone who speaks a certain language perceives and understands words in a slightly different way to the next person. And so I wanted to have some Easter eggs in there for Vietnamese speakers, but also some funny Easter eggs in there for non-Vietnamese speakers as well.
Thank you. Can we talk a bit about how migration to Australia affects all of the families in these books? Peter, can we start with you?
I have this theory that I think one thing that I think is interesting about Greeks is the level of cultural capital that isn't recognised. Mm. So I deliberately titled my book with the word poor in it because low socioeconomic doesn't have the same impact on a title. And I really wanted to draw attention to the fact that where my parents are from, they would be, although they're very poor and they don't have a high income, they are regarded in some ways of having a level of cultural capital because of the fact that my parents just both valued education, even though they didn't have much money. That's kind of it, really. I just, that's the really, but also Greeks have this thing called diaspora schizophrenia, where they don't know where they're going to settle. So, you know, for us, it's like back and forth. We're going to settle in Australia. And then I was raised in Greece for 4 years, and then we came back, and then my cousins who are my age moved back over and started families over there. So, I, like, because of the way Greece is, the process of migration doesn't stop. It's an ongoing dialogue.
And it's interesting, the idea of home and the feeling of kind of love that the mother figure has, that Onid has for where she is in Australia and also from...
Can I riff off your library, the loss of library thing? My mum's a librarian, and so it was the library that raised me a lot. And so for me, library and family and home and culture are connected. And to riff off your language thing as well, you know, Greeks were like 400 years of occupation, and we had to learn our language at night. So we have this lullaby that we sing to kids, and I sang it to all my nephews intuitively without thinking about it. And it's basically, the translation is, let the moon shine very bright so I can go to school tonight and learn my language. And Greeks had to learn their language during night because they weren't allowed to learn it during the day because of occupation. But I think the thing that links all of our ideas is the idea that our family, language, culture is all connected as a value system. And that's just so different from other people. And we don't see ourselves as individuals per se, but as members of community and family. So I think maybe that's what really links our books, is that when we're writing, we're not really writing as people, as ourselves. We're writing for a broader community, which isn't us.
Does that resonate, Shankari?
God, 100%. Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I'm not even sure. It's interesting concepts of agency, right, which are actually very quite Western concepts and Western words. I don't sometimes think I know how to think of myself differently as or separately from family and community. There's a sort of hive existence and hive feeling that exists, and even the word, we were talking about this on Friday, the word duty, which I think often connotes a burden in some cultures. In our culture, is not a it isn't a burden. You know, they these are trade-offs that are made, and obviously we're humans, so you resent things at times. But also within a broader framework of understanding that your duties and responsibilities are privileges because you are part of a collective. And so we move together. You know, I don't... Yeah, it's very difficult for me to explain it except to say that I don't feel separate as an organism from my family or my community. And I see myself moving through time and space with them, even though pockets of us are left in different places.
What about the tension between the first and the second generation sometimes? Like the next generation in Australia, do you think it's exacerbated? Do you think the individual different kind of issues, like the pressure on having a conservative family, gender pressures, for example, do you think there is more pressure for the second generation in a different country from the originating one?
I think for me, I have kind of struggled to kind of compare, like, oh, you know, questions like, did my parents struggle more than I am and that kind of thing. But for me, I think the way that I think about it nowadays is to, rather than to compare the struggle, I think just to approach it with compassion and say, our experiences and our struggles are simply different. And I would say that the idea of family as a value system Sylvia, the character, the protagonist in Funny Ethnics, is really, she really grapples with that because she's also influenced by these ideas of individualism in Australia. And so there is that friction. Mm. Personally, for me as an artist, I have embraced the idea of community and value as community and family as a value system in the way that I approach art making as well. Mm. So for me as a writer, I see myself as contributing to Australian literature, not just Vietnamese Australian literature, but Australian literature. And so I think Funny Ethnics, I wanted to simply put out a work for any reader within the literature-loving community who likes to be challenged, not just in understanding different cultures, but also understanding how stories can be written. Mm. And so I didn't really want to follow the usual three-part narrative structure. I wanted to challenge that as well. There isn't a clear three-part act in Funny Ethnics, by the way. Sorry to spoil that for you. But, yeah, I think I've absorbed community and family values in many different parts of my life, and creating literature, I view myself as part of a wider literature-loving community as well.
There's a few moments for, like, a definite generational clash, and that could happen anywhere at any time, and it is all of the time. But both of you, interestingly, are approaching, like, there's a few different scenes in each of your novels around getting one's period. I have to bring it up because I think that really highlights. Can you tell us about the age attainment ceremony? And then afterwards, can you share that particular scene and that contrast between the older and the younger generation? Whoever would like to start first, actually.
Yeah, okay, I'll just be as fast as
possible. Oh, me?
Go, Peter, tell us all about it. So just very briefly, that when girls attain their age or age attainment, when they start to get their period or start to menstruate, there's a ceremony in which they are dressed. My mother's just going, oh, my God.
Hey, your teenage son is also loving this.
Yes,
well.
My son is loving this. Thank you.
It's all my fault.
There is a ceremony, I'll do this as quickly as possible, where you are dressed like, essentially dressed very well like a bride, and the elders in your family bless you and the community can bless you. And so sometimes you could have like a few hundred people become notified. He's like, it's true. And so the sort of, you know, gender analysis is that it is to tell the community that the child is now a woman and is able to be married. What I wanted to do in the novel was to have the protagonist reclaim that ceremony, which can be quite uncomfortable for a girl, or very uncomfortable, but to reclaim it as something, as a blessing from one's elders, in particular the women in one's family, to bless you as your body changes and as you have the capacity, should you so wish to avail yourself of that capacity to bear children. Even if you don't, to receive the blessings of the women and the powerful women in your family.
Yeah.
Very, very different experiences over here. I guess Sylvia in the book, she doesn't really have much of an understanding of periods from her mum. It's something to kind of like speak about in euphemisms. I think I've highlighted that in parts of the book where her mum simply says, oh, you know, when you have your period, you can just tell me that you be. But be doesn't actually mean period. It just means that you have incurred something, kind of like you've incurred a fine. And so, again, the opacity, like, we just don't talk about much.
And not knowing, not necessarily, Sylvia not necessarily even knowing the word, like,
no,
what
doesn't
that word
know.
Is in order to communicate this with her parents.
So no.
That chasm between the kind of older generation and the younger generation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this younger woman not wanting to actually do that ceremony, but it's kind of the pressure of that older generation. It's interesting seeing those moments that are really, I thought those two scenes highlighted beautifully. Yeah.
I did want to say Sylvia might not understand much about periods from her mum, but she does gain a lot of knowledge about periods from another Vietnamese Australian person called her best friend, called Tammy, who is her best friend in the book. And Tammy kind of guides Sylvia to using tampons and things like that. So check it out. It's all really great.
So just one last question. Can I ask what is next for all of you? Are you working on something or having a break?
Okay.
Did you want to say?
Sure. So I'm working on a manuscript at the moment, and I'm hoping it'll come out in early next year. And it's about a community set in far west New South Wales and the strength of that community in protecting one of their own when their own is in peril.
Great. Peter?
I want to write... those are family stories, and I want to incorporate them into sci-fi somehow.
Oh. Yeah. Intriguing.
Says the man who said he had no imagination.
Everything is autobiographical.
Yeah, I agree with that. 100.
Look, as a debut novelist, I'm still very much caught up in the world of funny ethnics. And I think being a writer is not just about the writing, the act of writing itself, but it's also about having a lot of conversations. And so through these conversations today with these absolutely brilliant writers and a brilliant chair like yourself, Gemma, I'm learning. I'm continuing to learn, and I'm sure that will be absorbed and come out in the next work that I might write.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it has just been such an absolute joy to speak to you all today. And I think we've all learned so much. And their books are absolutely stunning and powerful. I urge you all to buy them. Thank you.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you so much.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.